Mr. Kwan, where are your parents from?
From what I understand, my grandfather on my mother's side was from China, and he must have come during the 1800s, and I believe when all the influx of the workers, what we call coolies, you know, to come up for the railroad, etc., and also to come for the gold rush, and then these poor people needed someone to write letters and also to organize into the family association.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Wong, W-O-N-G, or Mandarin, it'd be H-U-A-N-G, and that's a very well-known family name, you know, it's like the Brown or the Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore he was very successful in San Francisco, and he had my grandmother was much younger than he was, I'm sure, because I got to see my grandmother, but I never met my grandfather. We just hear talk about him. But he was very active in community affairs, and like such as helping the people who were ill in that family association, the Guang family. Now my father came much later, and he was a physician. Chinese herbalist.
When did he come to the States?
It must be the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
he was a Chinese herbalist?
Yes, right. And well, he was a very young man, and also, and my mother, that's when he met my mother. I understand they lived in the same building or something like that. You know, via my grandmother and all that, they made a match and then they married. And he, he was quite successful even before he was married, as I show you the picture,
mm-hmm.
that he helped start the Chinese hospital in San Francisco, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he donated his time to healing the sick.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, after he married, I was born in 1908, December, and he already had a family of two girls and two boys before me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born in Oakland in 1906 was the earthquake. That's when they moved over to Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, all I would only remember my own experience would be my childhood in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, as I told you before, that they were very, they adhere to the Chinese tradition, and basically it's learning. So they had my grandfather, my father, they had tutors actually imported from China to come over and teach us. So we were, particularly in my grandfather's case, I mean, who started businesses and also head of the Wong Association, and he, I understand, he even imported Chinese dramatic actors and actresses over to, you know, Chinese Dai He, what they
mm-hmm.
call it,
mm-hmm.
the Chinese opera. And so it was a very sort of like a cultural center from what I understand. So therefore we were given the same treatment when we were young. I mean, we were, even after to begin with, my mother and my aunt, I mean, they were very, very scholarly. And they know all the Tang poetries and all that sort of thing. And they were read stories to us from all the fairy tales and so forth, you know, particularly the stories from a Chinese studio, we know that backwards and forwards,
mm-hmm.
you know.
How much formal education did your mother have?
It would be totally Chinese,
mm-hmm.
totally Chinese. And she really did not
Mother was born?
Born in San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
As you can see, they were so old-fashioned that they had bound feet in those days. as I said, they were totally old-fashioned. And she didn't, she was very educated in Chinese, but not really English. Because you see, in those days too, the ladies were very, very sheltered, you know, very sheltered. And I even, when, as we were growing up too, I remember they mentioned about how times have changed, that girls would go to school and things like that. Prior to that, they were taught at home, you know. I mean, they had tutors at home.
Your mother had
tutors? Yeah. His grandfather had the scholar people and they would come in and teach him the Chinese, and then my aunt and my mother. So,
about the tutors that your father imported from China?
Yeah, from China.
Were they only for the boys in the family or the girls too?
No, they taught my aunt's children and our family. You see, our family ended up having 10 children, you see. 6 boys and 4 girls. And my aunt have, 8. So we were in a schoolroom by itself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, the teacher went out and started, as we grew up, the older ones begin to go into high school, and they start going to the Chinese schools. So therefore, I mean, that part was very, very old-fashioned. As a matter of fact, I remember there's a great big jar, and of course we would pin money or whatever you call allowances, but yeah, it would be an allowance. However, if we speak, my grandmother never knew an English. If we speak it one word of English in front of her, it costs a nickel. we're fine for speaking English.
How long was had this gone on?
Oh, that gone on until when she was elderly, and then.
How old were you when this stopped?
This stopped. Oh no, I think even in, I would say maybe through grammar school.
Mm-hmm.
Through grammar school. I would say that the early 20s,
mm-hmm.
we were still doing that.
The whole family?
Well, yeah.
The children?
Yeah. And of course we were, it's only, I would say only the boys, they were more aggressive and they go out and play with the other children. We went to school, grammar school in Oakland, called Lincoln High, the Lincoln School,
mm-hmm.
and which was right near Chinatown, and maybe about 5 or 8 blocks from Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke Chinese at
Chinese
home all the
time? Totally,
mm-hmm.
totally Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And from my own standpoint, is that even like my father being a doctor, he invested in businesses, and one of the businesses they had was an importing and exporting company. And he had the importing and exporting company had branches in Hong Kong, Canton, and also in Mexico. So when my older brother finished high school, he was sent over to the store. Each one of us were supposed to do that, you know, sent over to the store to manage the business, to look after our interests, you might say. And
where was your older brother sent to? Hong Kong?
No. Okay. Well, later on he did. Uh-huh. Later on he did. He was in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And on summertime, you know, during summer, we would go over there. Of course, he knew English, and he would do the translation. It's very interesting in those days, like even 20s, even the late 20s, I remember that when I went over to this store, my uncle was running the store. The uncle was on my father's sister's side of the family. So it was somebody from China, you know. There were people that had worked in this importing and exporting store that they would have been in San Francisco for 10, 20 years, and they've never even been down to Market Street because Chinatown was really a little China there. And I remember after high school, I went over there too, I mean to work, to basically to translate and things like that, and type envelopes and things like that. And also build ladings and go down and meet the shipments of foodstuff that comes in from China, the antiques, the porcelains and jars and things like that from China. And at that time, the people, all of Chinatown, because it's a small, not a large community, all the stores, they were all about the same. There were people completely, and they were always thinking, these gentlemen that that came over from China to work, you know, because the books were all kept in China. And they would think of, they write very often to China, all the time. And then they would always talk that when they have so much as a nest egg, and then they would go back to China. And I remember they kind of, at that time too, it was very interesting because in my teenage period, when we went over there and they, if we say something that is not too correct, and they would always kid about us, and they call us the Touju, you've heard of that before, I mean the natives, you know. And in other words that they use would be Juxing, which means the empty part of the bamboo. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean the bamboo, not the bamboo section. They're empty, which meaning that you have, don't have any brains. It's empty, like the Juxing, the in between part.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that really piqued my that wave of red flag in front of my face. You know, and of course, I was pretty good in Chinese, and I begin to take over their writing of the big signs in Chinese, you know, to demand the respect for me. You know. So therefore, I did was able to do that, and they did really have to. And at that time, too, culturally too, we were. I mean, other than the the community singing in American school of songs and all that. We also, the home was totally in Chinese. I know all the Chinese operas, and I would even go to, I acted in one of them too, you know,
mm-hmm.
and went along with my brother and some friends. You know, the association, they were very, very totally oriental in those days. And so, I think I told you the story about how from there, it was during this time that our store was selling some records, Chinese records of the Chinese stars in those days. And they were, in those days in the 20s, they were selling for $5 a disc. And just so happened that at that time, the same star were being imported from China and playing in San Francisco. And I talked to my uncle, and I said, gee, I mean, that's too much money. And we found out why, because these records were recorded by a German company and also a French company. One was Becker, it was Odeon, the French Odeon. I think they're still well-known record names, labels in both Germany and France. And you can imagine how they take all the equipment from Germany, Berlin to Hong Kong, record all from Paris to Hong Kong to record it, send these, in those days they were recorded on wax discs, from what I understand. And then they would take them back to Germany, manufacture the record, and ship them to Hong Kong, and Hong Kong shipped them to San Francisco. That's why they ended up costing so much money. And I said, gee, maybe we should see if we can record them here, because I know they record records. And in those days, the records were only selling for, 75 cents, a 10-inch record. So we did, and I went down and I went through all the companies. I went to Columbia, such a big company, who didn't care to bother with us. And finally, I talked to Victor. Of course, they didn't even care. Such a pity in business, you know. And I talked to Brunswick people, and the Brunswick people had a branch, and they're willing to do it. And the record was selling. We signed a contract with them, and it was we had to buy 3,000 records a year. That was a contract for 30 cents a record. And he was, my uncle was overjoyed. He said, oh boy, only 30 cents? I mean, if we sell them even for $1 a year, we're making a good profit. And which we did. We recorded it, and it was a huge success. I mean, instead of 3,000 records, we were ordering 100,000 records. I mean, to be sent back to Hong Kong, you know. So within a few years, not a few years, within 2 years, I mean, Brunswick dropped our contract. They went back to Hong Kong and recorded, and they heard about the success, you know, because Hong Kong being a very small, small town, you might say, and the news leaked out that this Chinese company is called the Gold Star Record. They were making such a huge success. So Japanese were going over there, and Columbia started a factory in Shanghai, and Victor Label went there and recorded. And then at that about the same time, the Japanese were invading Shanghai, and of course the whole thing went down the drain. You know, and of course we had no longer had the record company because nobody wanted to record it for us. So the gentleman who was with Brunswick, Mr. McGregor, and he had been with the company for a long time. When he landed the contract, he also wrote for himself a piece of the action, so to speak. I mean, the Brunswick was to honor him with 5 cents of record. So in other words, if he sells 3,000, he 5 cents of each record, Brunswick only get 25 cents, in other words. And of course, when he got swindle, that's what he said, swindle out of the contract with Brunswick. And he got very angry and he started his own recording company. And he asked me to join him to learn the recording business so we could go back to China. Everybody thought the war won't last too long, that we would learn how to restart the business. That's how I got into recording business. And because we were not ready to do that yet, and at that same time, I mean, radio was very, very popular. And in San Francisco, there were many, those popular radio shows were like Cecil and Sally, Ebb and Seth, which is sort of like a London Mather, and also some musical programs and all that. And he started in a record network, which they call transcriptions. And they were recorded on very large discs. This was about the same time when Warner Brothers have sound on film, like the Al Jolson. Mm-hmm. And so, because each disc would play for 15 minutes, so they can have a quarter hour. If it's a half hour show, it'd be just all they need is two discs. And then what he did was have a record transcription library. That was very successful at that time. So from there, that's why how I got interested in American music. And I really had to completely wash my own brain and start studying music. And also beside that, they had the drama, you know, on those records. And I would go over to Cal and I'd take up the language and order those classes and also I study music privately, and to study composition privately.
What kinds of classes were you taking at Cal?
I took some harmony, mm-hmm. and then it was English. Of course, I went through high school already, and I went through those whatever classes pertained to acting and things like that. You know. There were not too many. Even a poetry class, it was all English, because basically it's English, right? I mean, all the languages. So that's what I did. But it was very difficult because I could only do it summer, and then because I'm working full time. And before I knew it, I was, beside recording, I became an assistant director. Now, it sounds very highfalutin, the name. But what we did was inside of a studio, you know how a studio functions. There's a control room,
mm-hmm.
and where the mixer is mixing the music and it puts a microphone in, and inside of where the actors are. And then also they have what sound effects and things like that. Someone has to be inside that has to have the script, and then they would there'd be hand signals between the director and the assistant director inside the studio. So being young and bright and very ambitious, so I became an assistant director. And when we moved down, San Francisco were doing a lot what they call the soap operas. And then the motion picture business was just getting very, very big. And they had one tremendous show, and that was a transcontinental program called the Lux Radio Theater. And Cecil B. DeMille was the narrator on that, almost. He was a producer, you know. And so Hollywood became very, very big. There's no way to go but come down to Hollywood. So the whole company moved down to Hollywood. And this was in the late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And we all came down, my brother also was with him. And we came down and from there. And by that time I know the craft pretty well. And I was made producer. So I produced this radio program. And I direct and produce.
But which studio were you working as assistant director?
Well, this was, no, by that time I was a full director, which was for the McGregor Solid,
mm-hmm.
that's the name of it. So what he did was we were producing they were called strip shows, and one of them was the House of McGregor, you know, it was family affairs or something, and the other one was Mutiny in the High Seas, it was like Mutiny in the Bounty. Lady Courageous was a lady who runs a newspaper, and Cecil and Sally. That was the one that by that time the studios down here were better equipped than the because it was brand new, and so they were able to equip the studio. So we were able to function very well, and by that time the recording and also the microphones were all modernized. By this time, I mean sound on film were very, very well known. And so that was my job, was to produce those shows. And the producer, what the producer does is to buy the scripts and also direct each show and hire the actors. So that was my job. Well, that lasts for quite some time, all through to the 40s, until World War II came into being. In World War II, what I was doing, I forgot. Now, in those days, when you record on a disc, you see, on a disc, if you make a mistake, you have to junk the whole disc. You have to start all over again and do that. Now, besides recording those dramatic shows, I also did the musical shows, which are my learning how to the music, and all that I can read scores. And in those days, the Standard Oil Symphony Hour was one of the big shows, and because we had a very large room, a large studio rather, and we could accommodate those large orchestra, you know, over 100 people playing in there. And I had a good memory. I would remember the score when each, you see there are microphones all over the place. You have to know which one is going to be a solo and all that, and we would open that mixing pot to bring in the music. So I did that. And also at the same time too, the record company was beginning to start, and Capitol Record. So the first 10 releases of the Capitol Records, I mixed them. Well, mixing means blending the music. You're behind me. You take all of the microphones and the parts and you mix them in properly. So that's what I did. And we had to do almost everything in those days. If you're mixing and dramatic and all that, you really have to know what you're doing. So, I mean, from there on, World War started. World War started. And oh, I mean, I forgot to tell you that I also produced the skating records for a gentleman called Irving Fogel. And he was a very enterprising gentleman. And what he did was the skating ring all over the country skate to organ music. Mm-hmm. And because the organ fills the whole room, you see, and then they would have a tempo. And also the tempo has to be exact. And what I bought for the company, you know, like a metronome, a little fashion metronome, and I would set it, you know, and I would set it in front so that the one who's playing, it had to be exactly smooth because of the skaters glide, you see, and it's a little bit slower. So I did that for him, and what happened is in the beginning, when these, they were beginning to have unions then, and they're being paid by the hour. So if they make a lot of mistake and within an hour have to repeat it 5 or 6 times, so they're actually losing. So one day I told him that I can devise a way of how to reduce the wasting of the time or the talent's time. Even if he makes a mistake, I say, keep on going, you know. And then what I did is I just simply have 2 turntables and I match the sound where he made a mistake, and I jump to the one where the mistake doesn't happen. Just before the mistake happens, I turn that sound off and I turn in the other one. Now the whole thing, it's tricky because I have to know exactly how to the timing of tempo so the beat doesn't stop, you see, it's correct. Now that was one very important thing. He remembered that, and he was very grateful. We become very good friends, and he was a Jewish gentleman, and he liked Chinese, you know. I mean, they too were like a minority. And when World War II came on, the War Department, he became a colonel. And what happened is that he came to us and told us that up in Alaska and also in Africa, the civilian soldiers were committing suicide and doing all kinds of crazy things because they were not used to the war. And they found out in Alaska, there was one little island, Atoll or something like that, I forgot the name, where they didn't have these problems. And they went up to find out why they didn't have such suicides and things like that. Is that they were happy and they weren't revolting and having all kinds of trouble. Was that a gentleman up there, a soldier, had a little radio station, and they imitated what they were doing at home. You see, these were people that would completely displace, so to speak, into a cold area. They might come from some warm climate or something like that. And they worked their energy out by having a radio station. And then from then on, the War and Navy departments realized that, you know, and they started a radio network for the soldiers. Now, it's very difficult to create new things. You really have to buy what talent, acting, and all that. What they did, they were taking what we call air checks. Air check meaning when the radio, we just turn on the radio and record the whole program. Now, within the program, there are a lot of commercials. So the War and Navy Department said, we can't do that. It's a captive audience. Mm-hmm. So the main thing, the only thing to do is to lift those commercials out and substitute some music in them. And that's when Colonel Fogel realized that we were very useful. Now, what I did, and also another chap named Chang, and now Chang is an Occidental boy. I mean, he's Caucasian, but he was one of the ones that went to China to record our music. because it was, recording was a very small world, you might say. So he also were able to do, we worked that out amongst ourselves. It was with another company. So then Major Fogel came, or rather Colonel Fogel came and talked to Mr. McGregor and also this company. He said, from now on, he said, we have to appropriate your facilities, maybe one day out of the week, just to lift up these commercials. We were doing that before, you know what, I mean, it just was so successful. He said, no, we have to have him full time. And then before they say full time, they say, I'm sorry, we've got to get them in the army. And that was funny because I was still a young man, you know, and he insists on giving us a commission, and he indicated it. And he said, well, he won't work on it if you won't give him. So finally he got for a commission, which was a first lieutenant. And then by that time it grew like topsy. It did well. I mean, it was something within 3 or 4 months. We had actors, we had producers, and the colonel of that outfit was Loretta Young's husband, had all the stars. We have the motion picture people backing us, and the USO and whatnot. And what happened is that even in Santa Ana, they have the best musicians, and we have our own band, and the writers are still, like the producers of the Jack Benny show was in with us, and the producer of the musical director was Meredith Wilson. As a matter of fact, I was went into the army the same time. We were sworn in the same time with Meredith Wilson. So I stayed in there until after VJ Day and went back to McGregor, and I continued producing shows. But then, however, television started. And I left McGregor and tried to get into television. But at the same time, when I was young, I mean, my father taught me calligraphy, and, you know, and I had an interest in art, so I did a lot of painting and things like that. And 20th Century Fox was making a new picture called The King and I, and they wanted some Chinese that had the ability to design and all that, and I worked for that. After I left McGregor, and I worked for Irene Sherrod, who was the designer of the whole show, and I did the design, particularly the Valley Secrets, you know, Uncle Tom's, you know, all that, I did that. And I found out that working in picture wasn't so good because the moment the picture is over, I forget, you know, so I went back to the network. I went, by that time, actually, Lud Gluskin on CBS knew me, you know, because I had recorded, he knew me in the army. And so I went to work in CBS. I was actually, what happened, I also knew the vice president of program, Harry Ackerman was his name, and he was head of the all program, you see. And I wanted, because I had been directing in radio, and I thought I wanted to go on directing too. Well, I did the Hollywood Radio, Hollywood Theater of Stars, and which was for the Skippy Peanut Butter, and that wasn't so good because they simply, in those days, the contracts were for 13 weeks, 26 weeks, or 52 weeks. I was lucky; I did about 2 years of it, and then pretty soon they drop you and go to another show, you know. And I said. That won't do. I'm Chinese. I mean, very practical. Mm-hmm. I think I want to continue, and I want to work 52 weeks a year. And the only thing that I know about show business by that time, and I say, gee, the only thing that I have to have all the time is music. So I went into the music department for CBS, and I stayed there until I retired.
Doing what in the music?
Our music. Well, we put. In the beginning, I worked on some shows, which is putting music to the shows. But then we begin to grow when I first went there, they just had about two or three programs. And within a year or so, we had something about 10 of them there. And when Mr. Gusson, he said, oh, he said, forget it. He said, you're going to run it. So that's what I did. I assisted him, and the main thing is what we have to do, we have to go look at all the shows and then assign a single musical director to that particular show, you see. Because we will each week, the shows they all have a deadline. They have to be ready to be shipped. Now, what happened in terms of filmmaking, in making a film, what they do is first you have a script, right? Which is what you call the studio. They shoot it in the studio or shoot it outside. And after all that shooting is done, they bring the film, they shoot about maybe 5 or 10 times more, sometimes a lot more. And they boil it down to the half hour or the 1 hour or the quarter hour. And they would select all like in making a motion picture, let's say there's a room full of people. And first they have a long shot. They shoot a long shot of the whole room. And then they would later on narrow down to the important person. Or maybe a two person talking or three person talking. So afterwards, then they would shoot the same scene again, just only the person who is talking. Single, just his face, and then shoot the reaction of the other person that he's talking to, like if he's angry or something, you know. Now, and then all this film is taken into a cutting room, and the cutting room, the director and the cutter first do a rough cut, what they call rough cut. He takes the script, and he follows the scene, and then they would take a musical program, and then they shoot the shot of the music and of musicians playing away, and then they pan down to the room where they were dancing, you know, and then he will cut that scene in, and then the next thing he'll cut to where the two dancers are dancing, you see, waltzing around, and then he will cut to the man talking to the girl, you know, I mean with his face talking, you know, and then they will cut to how the girl react to what he is saying. Now that takes a lot of time. Now all this had to boil down to about 25 minutes because they all vary. Because you see, out of the half hour, it may be only 22 minutes because the other will be commercials. It all depends how long the commercial is used up in that half hour. So after that is done, only then can we put music to it. Because music is a continuous thing. Once you start the music, it's if it's 2 minutes long, it's 2 minutes long. You cannot. So they have to cut. So therefore, music is the last thing that they do. Now, in the meantime, there's a deadline. The show is already scheduled to go on air. Now, if the people who is producing the show, and the cutters and the directors, don't like it, they say, oh, recut it. Some shows are being recut many, many times before they get the right the sequence. Because it may be in the shooting that they've been shooted from, you see. So therefore, I mean, the low man on the totem pole is the music department. Because until they have it all down to exactly the same way, that's the only time they can compose the music or add the music to it. So therefore, they have to have somebody that knows the whole sequence to keep in charge of the whole shebang. And that's what I experienced. Because I've been the other head of the technical production department for the Army, and finally the whole thing. And that was what I did. And of course, we worked with composers and secret that the studios are scheduled for. It's also then they have to report to me because ultimately I'm responsible. We don't get it out in time. So that was the big part of all I did. Now the other thing you asked me about why in San Francisco, the great change was funny how what we expected, what I expected, particularly with my Chinese background, and also my interest in Chinese music and Chinese drama and all that, and the stories that was drummed into our ears from childhood. And the via this Chinese music, the opera stars from here, and I went into and tried to learn the craft of recording, the art of recording. And it went into the other side, went into the American way of life, you might say. And from then on, I was just totally Americanized, you might say. Although I would say the only time that I indulge in any Chinese activity would be going down to Chinatown and eat some Chinese food, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
But although when I go back up north with the family, then they're all very, very Chinese again. And it's very funny, like nowadays when I talk to my aunt or my older brother or any of the elder friends and all that, then I can go into my Cantonese very easily. And like the young people, I mean, I know they won't think of it in terms of English, they're just speaking English. And it was a very 180-degree switch. So
Your recreation, pretty much, would you say, was Chinese when you were younger?
Oh, totally.
Did you
totally
play baseball or things like
no,
that?
No, we didn't do that because, as a matter of fact, when I was young, we didn't do much of activities like that at all because it was very, 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 very Chinese.
So the kinds of things that were done during your spare time were?
Were, yes, Chinese. All
Chinese. Listening to
music
operas.
Chinese, yeah. Well, we would listen to the current popular tunes and things like that, you know, but not that much because radio was just beginning. When radio started, then I would. But although, I mean, I had a radio by my best. I enjoy music regardless of what it is. But in my childhood, the music, the Chinese music, the lyrics were very important to me. And therefore, the content, the storyline, you see. Actually, the Chinese music is very simple, you know. It's just only one line melody. They don't think in terms of harmony, you know. And so therefore, I mean, the thing that carried it would be the tempo, plus the different kinds of, even the melodies are traditional melodies, and then they just change the lyrics. They have very set melodies, you know. And since that time, I've begun to analyze it, and they were really basically from Peking opera. And then, but when it got to Canton, and then what they do is they add the Cantonese dialect to it. Or like this last time when I went to Hong Kong, I happened into one of the, some night I would like to have you and your husband come over and I can show you my slides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, Hong Kong, after I left mainland China, I stayed another 2 weeks in Hong Kong, you know, because I thought I would take some pictures. Because I really didn't have a chance to really photograph the way I wanted, because while in China was very much like a Grey Line tour.
Mm-hmm.
And as you saw, I was snapping pictures while on the train or on the bus. And they would say, you go up the wall, you say, well, you, at such and such a time, we'll all be back bound by the bus, or else nobody's going to take you home, you know, that sort of thing. So you're under pressure. And I thought I'd go into Hong Kong and take pictures there. So I did, and you saw some of those pictures. But what happened is that, as luck would have it, I ran smack right into Hurricane Elaine,
mm-hmm.
or Typhoon Elaine, they call it. And they call it eight balls of bat hole. I mean, that means it's very serious.